Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Our topic tonight is one that I stumbled into, and stumbled into it through my interest in China. And it happened because I took a trip. My children were in school in Beijing, and I wanted to take them on a vacation one March, about 2-3 years ago, and we went up to northwest China to visit some Buddhist monasteries and grottos, and I was sort of dimly aware where we were going. I'd been there, but I'd usually taken the train or flown, and of course, it was coal country. And the experience of that trip led to a whole sort of series of revelations that coal was at the heart of one very huge challenge for China, indeed for our own country as well. And that, as you all know very well, coal lies at the heart of the whole climate change challenge. In the case of a country like China, it's very primary because some 70 to 80% of its primary energy, electricity, comes from coal. In our own country, it's about 50%. And you all know the process. Coal trapped conveniently, quietly, harmlessly in the ground for millions of years, gets dug up, burned, carbon goes into the atmosphere, and you get this whole chain reaction leading to warming, to changes in climatic patterns, and you all know what happens on down the line. Very complicated, has lots of influences on various sort of biological cycles when it comes back down in various ways into the ocean, onto high plateaus where there are glaciers. And I want to talk a little bit today about one area of this chain of cause and effect in China, which we suddenly realize is of incomparable significance that nobody thought much of for a long, long time. And finally, you know, I want to conclude a little bit on the sort of seminal importance of China. Indeed, actually, it's the U.S. and China in the whole climate change wager. Because together, contributing close to 50% of all the greenhouse gas emissions, it is very easy to say and true that if the U.S. and China do not get in the game, and we are not in the game, there is no game. The U.S. Didn't ratify the Kyoto Protocols. It signed them and then unsigned them. In any event, they probably would not have passed Congress at that point, just as Clinton was leaving and Bush was coming in. China signed them, but as a developing country, which did not oblige it to set any defined limits. And so both of these countries sit at the heart of the matter of any multilateral effort to come to terms with climate change. And then, yes, unless the U.S. and China can find a way to begin to partner on this question and begin to gain some momentum, I think it's going to be unthinkable that the meeting in December in Copenhagen, which follows the Kyoto meeting and will set up the regime for the next go-around, can be successful. And so these two countries are absolutely critical. And we have reached a kind of a tipping point moment in Sino-U.S. relations, indeed in American politics with the new president, and I think new recognitions in China about the challenge that they confront, that it actually isn't a long-term challenge alone. It's a short-term challenge, and it has consequences. And I want to talk a little bit about that. And ultimately, to migrate up onto the Tibetan Plateau, this area which I have come to think of in a very different way in the last year or so than I did before. Now, if we back up a bit, we know that before the Industrial Revolution began, this is just in a very general sense for those of you who aren't deep in the weeds on climate questions, that there were about 280 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. We've now gained 100 parts per million. We're around 380. Some people think 450 is the absolute limit. Other people think that's way too high, and that by the time we get there, there'll be so many effects having been triggered by elevated temperatures that it will be catastrophic. So however you look at the magic number of where we have to stop, we're too far. And there's no way to arrest that number, even if the world girded its loins and did everything conceivable right now. It would still be a huge time lag in what happens in terms of the Earth's atmosphere and the parts per million of carbon and the effects that they would have. So the question is, can we stay under 450? And the second, even more important question is, 450 too high? That's a number you'll hear a lot about. China is now the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world, surpassing us by some accounts last year. Now, on the other hand, if you look at their per capita emissions, they're five times less than America. And if you look at their historical emissions, they're infinitely lower than America. So there's a kind of an imbalance, an equation that has to be factored out between present emissions, per capita emissions, and historical burden that each country has put into the atmosphere. As I said at the outset, the primary culprit in all of this is coal. And the development that the world has experienced, which has been largely beneficial for many societies, including our own, has been fired in large measure by coal. And the U.S. and China are both richly endowed with coal. And there is no hope, no chance, doesn't matter what anybody does in the next 10 or 20 years, that we are going to get away from coal. It's just simply too abundant and too cheap. So the question is really, what can be done about coal? That's the heart, a heart of the matter, or a big piece of the, a big wedge in the pie chart of where the problem resides. China has 13% of the coal reserves of the world, and the U.S. Has even more. China burned 2.74 billion tons of coal in 2008. Now, I think that'll go down this year because of the economic crisis that we see in the world. Indeed, some of you may have seen recent articles reporting on the air in Beijing, which for years now sometimes can go for weeks without the sun coming out or the blue sky appearing, has suddenly gotten better. Partially through the efforts that were initiated during the Olympic Games, but I think largely through the economy. In China, there are some 14 to 15 deaths a day in coal mines. There's a huge number of mines, and as the price of coal goes up, more private mines, which are very poorly managed, very Dickensian, very few safety precautions, very poorly ventilated, that skyrockets. So coal in China, and any of you who've driven across China or taken any trips outside of the cities, you will know that coal figures very largely in the success of this country. 11% growth rate, 10% average for the last decade. Now it's down around 6%. That's a whole other set of problems it poses for China in terms of social stability. But at the heart of this matter is development, and at the heart of development lies energy, and the heart of energy lies coal. I think it would be fair to say that evolution of consciousness about this problem in China has been quite rapid and not too dissimilar from the evolution of our own consciousness in this country. This is a relatively new issue for all of us. We are all something of amateurs, although some scientists, of course, specialize in certain aspects of it. But the truth is, if you look at the climate change problem, the solution will have to involve a whole mosaic of efforts, from science to technology to finance to policy, government involvement, civil society involvement. There's a whole kind of ecology of inputs that are going to be required to bring about a meaningful and rapid enough change to get anything done. And so in this sense, I think China has begun to realize, to have evolved away from their initial sense that the climate change issue, when people like me would come over and talk about it, they'd kind of roll their eyes and say, yeah, this is sort of an issue for you developed countries, and you'd like to thrust it on us and slow down our development, and this is a long time in the future, and we really can't be bothered with it right now. That has changed. It changed in a lot of ways. Changed because I think the Chinese are beginning to realize that not only are there long-term consequences, there are short-term consequences. They're beginning to be affected by it, sometimes in ways which may be just circumstantial, but since the whole notion of climate change and the threat as a threat has now been lofted, and in certain ways incorporated in official doctrine and official statements, people tend to attribute things to climate change that may not actually be caused by them. So there's a very rapid, I think, evolution of thinking. However, China's still not willing to commit itself to defined limits, to a cap-and-trade system or a tax or something like that. Of course, neither are we. And the reality about China's position is that they believe fervently that the developed countries should take the lead and that their challenge is to follow. And so they are, in effect, waiting for the United States. And it's interesting, in conversations in China over the last 6 months, you know, I would talk about this. I would say that when the Obama administration comes in, this is after November, there are going to be some big changes. And you could see sort of the wheels turning. And there was a lot of uncertainty. I mean, who were these people, Obama? Who were they going to bring in? And what were they going to do to us? What are they going to say to us? There was this sense not only that the United States should lead, but that China really was going to be acted upon, because, in fact, there is a long history of that. Now, here there is a terrific paradox at work, and one that's not, I think, been properly analyzed or appreciated. As the United States power, whether you look at it militarily, politically, financially, has diminished in the world, and this is a relatively recent phenomenon, what has curiously happened is psychologically the playing field has leveled somewhat. The old paradigm where the U.S. would lecture at China, whether it was about how to run their finances, their stock markets, how to do human rights, how to develop, how to do this, how to do that, very subtly, in the last 6 months, this whole kind of interaction has changed. And in a way, this is a very hopeful thing. Because if there was anything that made the Chinese neuralgic about partnering or cooperating or listening to us, was precisely that attitude of the West lecturing China. Now, I think they contemplate American mortality, frailty, weakness, both with a certain sense of relief, but also with a certain sense of trepidation. It's almost as like the, you know, you suddenly the adults vacate the building. And I think China's beginning to realize that, and this is, of course, I think all across the board in terms of its role in the world, that it is becoming a great power. It does have some responsibilities. It does need to lead. And a good place for it to begin to step out into this leadership role in the world is by way of a partnership with the United States. So this is a kind of a hopeful, incipient trend, which I think is worth watching. It's not completely developed, but I think it has some promise. Now, what the Chinese see now that they... We have Obama in office. Hillary Clinton goes over there and she tells them we have to collaborate. She even went so far as to say that human rights shouldn't prevent us from cooperating and collaborating on other issues. We worked very closely with her on her speech. I think she went a little overboard there, but I take her point that there are other important things that these two countries have to transact between them if the world is going to be brought back from any number of brinks. This particular brink, of course, I think is the most menacing of all over the long run, which is climate change. So I think they begin to kind of get a sense that everything that they heard in the outside world wasn't simply a ruse to slow them down and heap the burden on them for something that they really didn't feel they were responsible for. And what are they seeing? Well, you'll remember last winter, there was this incredible freeze in South China. China had never seen anything like this in recorded history. It was ice, snow, the trains came to a halt, power plants had ran out of coal, the whole electricity grid went down. It got so bad that the premier of China, Wang Jiabao, had to go from Beijing all the way down to Canton. This is just before the Chinese New Year, where there were 800,000 people waiting in the train station to go home. It was a near riot. And he went out with a bullhorn, and he said, in effect, you know, we haven't done our job very well, and urged them to be orderly, to understand. And interestingly enough, the last time Wen Jiabao was seen with a bullhorn out in public was in Tiananmen Square in 1989 with Zhao Ziyang, when he went out to try to calm the students down and get them to go home. It was a kind of a haunting moment. So that was one thing. And then, if you look at the Chinese press or you're in China and you hear things, a number of other things began to happen that, you know, again, were circumstantial, but really did start to get people's attention. There was one case that summer in a southern city called Zhanjiang. And I had to read this article in the paper again and again and again because I couldn't quite believe what I was reading. And the article said, and it's subsequently been corroborated, that in one 24-hour period, this city had 29 inches of rain. Now you'll say, okay, one city, one aberrant weather pattern, no big deal. Well, it turns out the Chinese keep very good historical records that go back, you know, centuries, millennia. And nothing like that had been recorded in this area ever. And then I saw another picture in a paper, again, circumstantial, but these things begin to add up. And in a country like China, where there is a kind of a highly evolved notion of sort of fate, they have an impact. There was a picture in the paper of about 100 people pushing a jet aircraft, what looked like across a lake in Tianjin. And the article said that there had been this in North China, on the North China Plain, which had been in a state of drought, dire drought. What had happened was North China in Shandong Province had had one of these freak storms. It had dropped more rain than at any time in Chinese history on this airport and a lot of other places. And this was the effect of it. But again, paradoxically, the rain came during a time of drought. It sort of washed away. Didn't recharge aquifers, which are falling on the average of 3 to 4 feet a year now across North China. And you begin to see more and more things like this occurring. And it is very, I think, unsettling for the leadership. They're not quite sure, you know, to what to attribute this, but it does gather their attention. Now, water is key in this recognition of the way in which climate change is affecting China and the way in which I think the leaders of China are beginning to understand the effects of this problem. There's been a diminution of rainfall on the North China Plain. And this has led to these droughts. And this is the breadbasket of China. This is the wheat-growing district, traditionally dry, to be sure. The south is the rice-growing region, very wet, sort of south of the Yangtze. But in North China, it's dry and it's wheat-growing. And they've had for the past 10 years a series of really serious droughts. Now, what's the remedy to these droughts? Well, the remedy is a project called the Nanshui Bei Diao, the South-North Water Transfer Project. Now, you may never have heard of this, but it's twice as big as the Three Gorges Dam. And what it is, it's as if you had decided one Saturday you were going to call a plumber into your house and you were going to re-plumb your house. What the North-South Water Transfer Project is to connect up via three canals, the Yangtze River and its watershed, to the Yellow River, which loops way up through Mongolia and then down across the North China Plain, and is what really was the foundation for much of Chinese civilization, because it brought the waters, brought water down from the Tibetan Plateau, down from Qinghai, up through Mongolia and down across the North China Plain. Once was called China's sorrow because it flooded so often. Now, in many years, in the summertime, it ceases to debouch at all out into the ocean. All the water's taken out of it. And so to remedy for this deficit, which admittedly is caused not only by drought, but by overtaxing its resources, they have decided to build this massive three-canal plan. One of the canals is the third one, which hasn't been built yet, is going to tap in way up high and loop around to North China and have to go actually underneath the Yellow River. Now, if you've seen the Yellow River, I mean, this is no small task of engineering. It's also going to have to be pumped up over one or two major mountain ranges. So this is big time stuff. The first canal was routed by the old Grand Canal. They kind of cleaned it out, and they're sending water north. The second one is going to come in from a tributary of the Yangtze and go to North China and Beijing. But this is you know, I mean, the world has never seen such contortions to solve a natural problem before. But this is what China is confronting, and this is how you know they're worried. And there also is a huge sort of effort all across North China, each county, each province, to shoot silver iodide, you know, rockets, artillery fire, planes sowing clouds. And there's even evolving a whole sort of field of law and of competition between cities, because as wind blows clouds down and one city tries to seed the clouds and grab all the rain, the next city and the next county and the next province, of course, are going to be deprived of that sort of airborne riparian right. So we've reached a kind of a crisis level in water. China has 757 cubic meters of water per person. That's one-fourth of the world average. But on the North China Plain, it's only 300 cubic meters a year. It's a very, very small amount of water. You can't dig a well on the North China Plain anymore by hand. It used to be every village had one. Now you have to go with heavy equipment and drill an artesian well. So we begin to see them becoming conscious around these very concrete problems. 400 of China's 667 large cities. And I should say, China has 160 cities of over a million people. You know how many the U.S. has? I think it's six or seven. It's just give you an idea of the scale of it all. 65% of all the water is used in agriculture, and 20% of this is wasted through inefficiency. Industrial uses are 24%, and it's only under half of that is recycled. So this is a real challenge for China. Now, I want to get up to a very concrete area to describe to you one of the places where climate change in China is really focusing people's attention. But we're really on the early, sort of the early stages of awareness, both in China and around the world. And that is on the Tibetan Plateau. Now, Tibet, I wrote a book about this region and, you know, the fascination that Westerners had for it. It used to be described as the blank place on the map. You know, it didn't get mapped until very late. Then it was sort of a spiritual epicenter, and then people imagined maybe there was copper, zinc, gold, something else up there. Otherwise, why was it so important? But it was actually a place of no great actual consequence. Symbolic importance, yes, and the Chinese are hanging on to it for dear life. It's a very difficult political issue. But of late, we've begun to appreciate it as something entirely different, and that is a place, sort of the reservoir for every major river system you can think of any consequence in Asia, from the Indus all the way to the Yellow River in the north. The Salween, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Brahmaputra, you name it. All of these rivers rise on the Tibetan Plateau. It starts at the Hindu Kush above, sort of in the upper part of Afghanistan. You move around to the Karakoram, K2 above Pakistan, then the sort of the whole arc of the Himalayas that rims the top of India, Sikkim, Bhutan, Bangladesh, and then heads north around Yunnan province and Sichuan, and then ultimately ends in the grasslands of Qinghai province to the north of northwest China. What this area now has begun to mean to more and more people as they begin to look at it with a different lens is this is the place where these rivers derive a good deal of their flow. Now, it isn't simply that all the water comes from the Tibetan Plateau. Much of it comes from monsoon rainfall, seasonal. But why the Tibetan Plateau is so important is because when the monsoons stop, and in dry seasons, that is when the 45,000 glaciers of the Tibetan Plateau begin to melt and release their meltwater into these rivers. thus evening the seasonal flows. In some rivers, it's 50% of the flow. In other rivers, it's below 5%. So it isn't as if when all the glaciers are gone, the rivers will never flow. It is that they will not flow all year long. In the meanwhile, as the temperatures rise, the glaciers are melting faster, and everybody's pretty happy. A lot of nice water, sometimes floods. And this also is an area which is very poorly understood in terms of climate, in terms of the interaction of, you know, temperatures on monsoons, on rainfall. But temperatures at high altitudes, at least in the Tibetan Plateau, are rising much faster than the global average. And this means the glaciers are melting at a much, they don't melt at a linear rate either. As glaciers melt, the land around them, the rock faces, the mountainsides that are exposed, then begin to absorb heat, and they melt even faster. And in fact, when glaciers melt, all of this, I hasten to add, I'm not an expert on, but I've begun to learn. Water tends to flow down crevasses. It lubricates the underside of the glacier, and the glaciers start to slip. And you get these massive lakes where glaciers used to be, backed up behind glacial moraines. And one of the dangers of the rapidly melting glaciers is what they call glacial lake outburst floods, where the glacial moraines will break, and you'll have these huge lakes suddenly just deluging down a river. But the problem of the melting glaciers, I would say, is the most frightening one, because scientists now understand that through ice core sampling on the Tibetan Plateau, that the glaciers have not been building up mass since the 50s. And you can see that very clearly in the ice cores. You know, it snows, but more and more of the precipitation on the Tibetan Plateau, because of elevated temperatures, comes down in the form of rain, not snow. So it can't pack up. And in fact, rain melts glaciers, whereas snow adds to them. So the estimate now is that by 2050, 2060, who knows, every estimate that I've seen is superseded by a new estimate that's more dire, more rapid, and more alarming. Because as I suggested, they don't simply melt in a linear fashion. They melt in an exponential faster, more and more rapidly as time goes on. I think many of you know that in the last 11 years, we've had 10 of the hottest summers. This is a global phenomenon. The World Glacier Monitoring Service, which collects data on 100 glaciers around the world, found that 2005 and 6 was the worst loss for ice mass on record. This last year, I think, was the third worst. And this isn't just limited to Tibet. You go to the Alps, you go to the Andes, you have a similar phenomenon. Glacier Park is soon not going to have any glaciers at all. But we don't really rely on that water the way Asia relies on the water from Asia, from the Tibetan Plateau. So this is a problem. What's in the ground, coal, goes up as flue gas, as carbon, methane, twice as deleterious in terms of its heat-trapping capacity than carbon. Climate, there's a warming. Climate changes. Then we get a whole other phenomena up in the Tibetan Plateau, which is the melting of the permafrost. And this is not only damaging to climate because, it releases water. And it lowers the level at which water remains perched on top of the permafrost, which is exactly the level to which the grasses on these very fragile areas, you know, millions and millions of acres of grassland on the northern side of the Tibetan Plateau. And so the roots of the grass are not equipped to go deep enough to get the water that follows the melting permafrost down. Moreover, when permafrost melts, you get decomposition. Permafrost is like a freezer. Freezes the organic matter so it can't release methane. When it begins to melt, then you get decomposition and you get the release of methane. You also begin to get desertification. partially because rainfall patterns have changed on this vast grassland area that's inhabited by nomads. We have a whole project with nomads in the Tibetan sort of Qinghai grasslands where we've been talking with them about what they've observed over their lifetimes of the last 30 or 40 years, not only in terms of the glaciers they've seen melt, but what's happened to pasture land, to grasslands. And what's happened is that the rainfall patterns have been disrupted so that whereas it used to rain rather more steadily during the wet season, drizzle kind of, now it's raining in sort of thunder showers. You get very episodic rainfall that comes and puts a lot of water on the ground, and then you don't get anything for 2 weeks, and thus you get a drying of the grasslands, and then you get desertification. So there's that whole phenomenon going on the sort of north face of the Tibetan Plateau. The ice mass is estimated to have decreased by 4.5% over the last 20 years. Now, that may not sound like a lot, except, in fact, it should be building, and instead it's melting. And it seems to be melting at more rapid rates each year. The temperature difference between the average temperature rise per decade on the Tibetan Plateau is 0.6 degrees Celsius. But the global average is 0.7 degrees Celsius for the century. So there's a huge disparity. But again, people really incompletely understand this because there are not a lot of meteorological stations up there. There's some very good Chinese glaciologists. But of course, often the Chinese government doesn't want to panic people. And so in a world where there is controlled media, the question is, what do you do? In our own society, there's a kind of a presumption that if you feed people information, they will both push their government and support their government in taking measures to ameliorate the problem. China is not quite at that state. Interestingly enough, China does have a real fluorescence of civil society. And the environmental movement is one area where there are more civil society NGOs than any other area, I think, except possibly public health. But still, there's a great ambiguity about civil society because civil society is independent. And it does push the government. That's the job of civil society. And the Chinese Communist Party is very wary about allowing any element of society to become sufficiently independent and well instated that they might be able to exercise undue pressure in a way that might challenge them. And so you have a curiously altered form of a government's relation to civil society as we are accustomed to it in a more open society. And this is a problem. So it's always important for any environmental NGO that might be talking about melting glaciers, talking about increased or decreased river flow, talking about dams, all of these things, they always have to keep a well-sanded fingertip in the wind to see which way the wind is blowing and to get a sense of what can the market bear, what can they get away with doing, with saying, when is too much, and when will they get them closed down? And that's a very difficult ecology of its own. So we find that this place, in a certain sense, is Tibetan Plateau, is a kind of canary in the mine shaft, one that's very incompletely observed. We have a project at the Asia Society, and I, in a moment, will show you just a few minutes of it. A number of years ago, I made several films with a mountain climber who has since been up Mount Everest five times, summited five times. He took the IMAX camera up Everest and did that 3D wraparound movie, which I'm sure many of you had. It was a spectacular film. And he began to, his passion was to get to the top of things. That was his thing. Mountain climber, mountain man. You know, not a deep thinker, just get up. He spent a lot of time in the Himalayas, the Karakoram, climbing, and he suddenly began to find himself noticing that the glaciers were disappearing because he would go back year after year around Everest. And he started a project, which we've teamed up with him on now, where he's gone back into to get these archives from 75, 100 years ago. He got all the photos of the Mallory expeditions to Everest in the 1920s. And it turns out that they did these huge photos of the Rombach and the Karta Glacier, and you know, sort of giant format photographs. So David Beshears goes up. He spends weeks doing this. Very expensive, I might add. And he goes and he finds exactly the ledge on which Mallory stood in 1921 and his photographer and shot the Rongbuk Glacier, and he takes another photo. He's now at Kanchenjunga, which is between Nepal and Sikkim. This is another huge ice field. This was photographed in 1908. The Duke of Abruzzi in Italy was a mountain enthusiast. In fact, there's in the K2 and the Karakoram, there's the Abruzzi Ridge named after him. So he went there with a cartographer, and he took these huge glass plate photographs of the ice fields. So we went and got them in Italy. And now David Beshears is back there right now doing these historical match photographs. Then he's going to K2 and the Karakoram in July, and then later in the year he's going to the Tian Shan Mountains, which are on sort of the north side of the Taklamakan Desert between Kazakhstan and China. And this is kind of the most graphic representation that I've seen of the consequences of what's going on. And it's very alarming. Very alarming. Because you begin to understand that these rivers, I'm going up in 3 weeks to an area on the Tibetan Plateau in western Yunnan province where the Yangtze River, the Mekong River, and the Salween River all begin within a very narrow band and huge snow-capped mountains and ice fields. So you begin to see that this area, which seemed to be of no consequence, suddenly is a kind of headquarters for, I don't know, nobody, I've seen so many different numbers, I hesitate to use them, but 2 billion people are in some way reliant on these rivers, and they are in jeopardy. And what's doubly difficult about this problem, and this gets back to the theme of the talk tonight, is this is not just China's problem. Yes, China will be affected. But you know, there is no law, there's an international law of the sea. Nobody much pays attention to it, but it's there. But there is no adopted international law of rivers. The Mekong flows down through Yunnan province, and there are 13 new dam sites the Chinese are considering building on it. And then it goes down past Laos, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia. All those countries are dependent on it. And yet China has it by the throat upstream. And the world has it by the throat up at the glaciers. China can't solve this problem alone. One atom of one molecule of carbon emitted here in Berkeley is exactly the same as one emitted in Beijing. It doesn't go through customs. You know, it doesn't care about boundaries. Now, the Chinese have a very sort of 19th century notion of sovereignty. You don't interfere in my affairs. I don't interfere in your affairs. Stay out of our internal affairs. We don't want to go there. Sudan, you know the story. They're very loath to see international humanitarian intervention anywhere. Burma, we don't do politics. We just trade. You know, Iran, all of these sort of bad actor countries. But China, I think, is slowly beginning to change too. And we see signs of this, for instance, in the six-party talks over North Korea. I mean, China has definitely intruded in the internal affairs of North Korea, not to the extent we would like them to, but they've been quite responsible. They've been played a quite constructive role in that very sort of critical set of talks. So they, too, are beginning to change. But the question is, can we both change together rapidly enough to form some sort of a united front on this issue? Now, President Obama has taken a very different position than President Bush. And he has, I think, set the track in the right direction for a collaboration with China on this question. I'm going over to China tomorrow for a meeting with 100 people from America and China to talk about. All right? Hillary Clinton says cooperate. Obama says let's get together. What do we do? Where do we begin? What's the project? Now, we've put out a little roadmap making some suggestions. You could look at the grid. You could look at carbon capture and sequestration. You could look at energy efficiency, sustainable sources of energy. There are a lot of things. But it seems to me, unless we do find a way in very short order for these two countries to really put some muscle behind this, it's going to be too late. I'm not particularly optimistic, I have to say. But I think this is the time, if there was a time, to try to put one's shoulder to the wheel to see if we can't practically find ways where the two countries can do something together. Because if we don't, I think it's very unlikely that this problem will be solved. China's growth rate has shrunk almost by half. They're very worried about social stability. They're very worried about employment. The last thing they want to do is to raise the cost of energy. The last thing they want to do is to have a whole new burden thrust upon them at this time when they have their eye fixed on survival and stability and continued progress. This is a challenge indeed. And I think it's one that the developed countries are going to have to recognize that we can't simply wait for them because they're going to wait for us. And that's what we've been doing for 8 years. They've waited for us. We waited for them. We blamed them, said, we're not signing because you're not playing. And they said, fine, we're not playing either. And nothing much has happened. So I think enough said. But this will be the challenge of the next 10 years. And if the United States and China can find a way to collaborate, I do think the other issues which tend to upset us and throw the relationship, as we refer to it, off the tracks, will also be somewhat easier to deal with, whether it's human rights or spy ships or missiles through embassy windows or whatever things come along, trade. So that, I think, is the challenge. And we'll watch over the next 6 months. These are critical months leading up to Copenhagen to see if there is some way that this collaboration, which now has been called for, whether it can be made flesh, whether the word can be made flesh. That's simply put. Now, listen, by way of ending, I want to show you a little bit of this project I mentioned because it's pretty graphic, and you'll see David Brashears talking about it a bit because this will show in the most graphic way what's happening to these glaciers. Okay. So I think this will, hopefully we'll hear some sound.
What I'm seeing when I make these trips to Mount Everest, to the glaciers, the east, north, west, and south sides, is something really astonishing. They're just disappearing. They're just vanishing. In fact, I think what I'll call the photo exhibit someday is, you know, Everest's vanishing glaciers. What's really shocking is that is how the rapid rate of retreat, you know, over the last 80 years. What's really exciting about this research for me is the peek back into history I get, because the record that I come back with relies on having my record matched against an earlier record. I look at the images, a lot of the mountains that I'm going to I'm familiar with, and then I reoccupy the same exact spot from where the photo was taken, take the same picture, and then match them together. In my journeys across Tibet and documenting glacier retreat, of course I'm interested in the impact it has on the local people. And I would say that right now the greater impact is in global warming and how it's affecting their growing seasons, the time of their harvest, the time of the planting, how the grass grows high on the plateau, things like that. Because In a bit of an irony here, as the glaciers are melting, they are providing more water at the moment. because there is still plenty of water locked up in the ice in these high altitude glaciers, and there will be for many years to come. So the local response to melting glaciers is that there's more water now. The response to the increase in the average temperatures is not good, and they do notice that more, because fundamentally they are farmers, they live off the land, they know the crop cycles, they know the growing season exquisitely well. I took this photo down here from in 2008. It was the same place that a photographer had stood to get this picture in 1921. And what you look for here is something, the line of the glacier here in 1981 on the West Rongbuk Glacier sitting below Mount Everest has now dropped from here to here. It's dropped over 350 vertical feet. And down here, it's just as dramatic. Again, I'm standing where a gentleman stood in 1921, Captain Wheeler. His photo shows this rock island exposed to this height. If you come down here to this picture, the glacier used to be here. It's dropped 400 feet further up the glacier, and that's true all the way across here, all the way up the West Rongbuk Glacier. It's just losing mass vertically, and just, it's not sinking, it's just all going up into the air, this water, or flowing down out into rivers and streams.
It's interesting, China, because it doesn't like to be lectured, it doesn't want a lecture. So it's very rare that you will see at least an official Chinese expressing views about what the U.S. should do and shouldn't do, because they don't want to have it done to them. I mean, I think there are many, many things that we could do to arrest global warming, and the cattle industry is only one of many things. But, you know, we're only slowly becoming aware of these things. I mean, a few years ago, who thought much about this? There's a very rapid learning curve that's happening. And I have to say, you know, the biggest problem in this country is not the new government, it's the Congress. And now we see that in the Congress, suddenly Obama had his cap and trade bill, you know, hidden in the budget. And he thought he had enough votes passed the budget by a simple majority, and suddenly there are 10 coal state Democrats who not so happy about cap and trade. So how that's all going to shake out, we don't know. But it's of critical importance to someone like me as I troop over to China and say, all right, what are you going to do? Here's what we're going to do. We don't know what we're going to do. Now, there's an interesting wrinkle to all of this. We were talking at lunch about this. Under the Bush administration, the Supreme Court did find that carbon was a pollutant. And Bush did nothing about it. He just let the ruling sit. He didn't try to, you know, to act upon it. Now, Obama is acting on it. So there's this second path of the Environmental Protection Agency that is treating carbon like sulfur dioxide and will proceed to try to limit it. And in effect, what that may say to the coal state Democrats, you don't like cap and trade? Just wait till the EPA gets their hooks on you. So there's actually a rather positive, we have a little bit of the marketplace working here. You don't like this? Take that. You don't like that? Better get used to this. So we'll have to see. So far, Obama's been pretty good. He's stuck to his guns at a very, very difficult time when it'd be just easy as the devil to throw climate change overboard.
There are a lot of different actions that this country could take internationally, nationally, state, private sector. Would the Chinese, do you think, respond more to one type of action or another if they're looking to us to lead?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And the truth is, all of this is happening now. And we don't quite know because we didn't do anything yet. We just talk. So until we actually do something, it's not going to be easy for us to get a real read off of China. Now, we're going to have this big discussion on Thursday in Beijing with a lot of the top climate negotiators and scientists. And, you know, our intention is to say, all right, what are you willing to do? And I think their reaction is going to be, all right, what are you going to do? So we're kind of sniffing around each other right now. But we certainly have gotten their attention. And I think we're getting out on the dance floor here. We'll see what happens. It's going to take some. There's really nobody yet in the American government who really understands China and climate. So that has to be worked out. There's some very good people who do climate, and Todd Stern, the negotiator, is a really smart guy. They have some good China people, but it's finding that strange blend. And I don't consider myself qualified I am a real Johnny-come-lately to this, but I'm smart enough as a good journalist to know when I'm onto a good story. And this is a good and scary story.
Well, how do you explain the fact that in the last 40 years, the temperature has increased only 0.002 degrees to the warmer side by the satellites operated by NASA, by real meteorologists, measuring the temperature from the satellite to the Earth? This sent a slight amount, and the oceans have only risen 0.01 inches per year for the last 40 years. How do you explain?
Well, listen, first I should say this is not
Hansen. Hansen, the guy that predicted in front of Congress in 1970
right.
that the temperature was today supposed to be four times hotter than it really is, he's an employee of NASA. And it didn't turn out to be four times hotter than it really is.
Well, there are probably 20.
All predictions are the same.
Yeah. There are probably 20 people in the room here who could give you chapter and verse on temperatures. One thing I can say, that these temperatures that you hear are usually global averages. And what they don't often account for is quite, you know, large disparities between certain regions. The other thing that you have to remember is the Tibetan Plateau, which is called the third pole, because it's the third largest, you know, ice mass area of ice mass in the world besides the two poles. It's very different from the poles in the sense when they melt, that water just goes into the ocean. Nobody's much dependent on it. You may submerge Bangladesh, you may lose Shanghai and the Maldives, but okay. But the water coming down off the Tibetan Plateau is water for 2 billion people. So if the temperatures are actually, have a look at these pictures. How do you explain a 400-foot drop in the Rongbuk Glacier in 75 years?
But they're taking the temperature from the Earth's temperature. When the Russians, when they went from...
Well, listen, I don't want to... I'm not an authority on global temperatures. I do know that when I see a glacier disappears, it's cause for alarm. Maybe we have time for one more, and then...
Maybe one more.
Yeah. Any right here.
We heard a lot about projects in China, a little bit about cap and trade. Do you see the CDM, clean development mechanism, as being something that's really greasing the wheels between the communication between the U.S. and China? China's got, I think, over 50% of the world's CDM projects.
Well, CDM, clean development mechanism, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is the way Europe sells offsets to China. If a factory in China is willing to do clean tech, it offsets the dirty tech in Europe, and the Chinese factory gets money. And the Chinese factory have gotten a lot of money. But it's not working very well. The critique of the clean development mechanism, and I think it'll be swept away and redone, is that they're giving money to people who would have done that anyway. So there's not much of a net gain. And so China loves it. But I think the EU is not quite so happy about it. Well, listen, thank you for your time, and thank you for coming tonight.
We have the European Commission here.
right here.
We do. Would the European Commission like to speak?
Well, I think we are concerned about CDM. You're right. We've put a lot of money into China, and the questions are whether it's actually really achieved anything. There are many, many skeptics to CDM. The question I'd like to ask, actually, is even as the central government in China starts to get a grip of this, and they are fairly technically competent, what's your feel about their actual ability to get the Chinese on the ground in the cities and regions? I mean, it's a governance problem. Is there any chance that they can actually move the rest of the country?
Well, this is a real problem, the differentiation between the central government and the provincial and county governments, where, you know, money talks. And the party can do things. It can't do everything. So the question is, what would it take at the central level to actually articulate a policy that would have binding effect at the provincial and county levels, where people are geared up to make money and to develop? The central government has adopted in the last couple of years an expression called, it used to be there were Fajan, development, was something you heard everywhere in China. Everything's development this, development zones this, that, and the other. They've changed it now to Kush, or Fajan, scientific development. And what they mean by that is they don't want to cancel out the glory of development by stigmatizing it. They want to kind of subtly reinvent the notion that the science part involves sort of environmentally sounder development practices. So they are beginning to evolve. And I think, actually, if you compared them to the Bush administration, they were infinitely more enlightened. There was a paradox in China, because if you look at the Chinese pyramid, the leadership at the top was quite smart. The provincial and the... environmentally speaking. The provincial and the county-level people were much more refractory and much more resistant. And the people at the bottom were relatively uninformed because of the nature of the media. In the United States, it was exactly the opposite. You had the top of the pyramid was totally brain dead. You had the states doing all sorts of interesting things, but running off in 10 different directions and trying to get together. And then on the bottom, I think you have a very rapidly evolving state of public consciousness. But now this is changing a little. So maybe there'll be greater symmetry between the two systems, and we'll see what happens. Okay. Has the EU spoken?
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.